Hello, today is November 3rd, 2021. This is the Talking Information Network, and we'll be reading from the Taunton Daily Gazette. So Many Good Memories by Chris Helms. In Raynham, the Raynham Park grandstands came down Tuesday. For three generations, workers pulled a steady paycheck there while bettors cursed their luck or cashed their winnings. Chris Carney, the Brockton businessman whose family owns the once vibrant Greyhound track, looked on as his crews demolished the walls, floors, seats, and judge's booth. "So many good memories," said Carney, as an excavator clawed down a string of lights. Raynham Park brought a touch of Vegas to Route 138 from the 1940s until Bay State voters outlawed dog racing in 2009. At its height, bettors would put down $500,000 on a Saturday night. The track once employed 1,200 people, Carney said. "It breaks my heart, but it was never going to stay what it was," said Carney, whose father, George Carney, built the park into a destination. The demolition marked an ending, but it's also a beginning. Chris Carney plans a new state-of-the-art betting facility for the property. The grassy circus will be home to warehouses. "The plans are nearly final," Carney said, "and his family will be filing them with the town in the next 2 weeks. Demolition will pause at the corner where the 1940s-era grandstand meets a 1990 addition, which is home to the current simulcast facility. That adjoining area will remain open for betting on greyhounds, thoroughbreds, and harness racers in the short term, but it too will be torn down to make way for the new betting center. Just before the excavators started tearing down the grandstand, Brian Ferreira rescued an old ice cream stand price list. Bettors could get a small coffee for 71 cents, a pack of smokes for $5.24, and a pencil for 14 cents, plus aspirin. Everything you needed for an afternoon or evening at the track. Ferreira, an employee of the Carneys for 21 years, said he'll repair the sign for display as memorabilia. "A revival of the property stands to benefit Raynham's tax coffers," Carney said. "An existing recycling facility will remain open. A truck driving school will continue to use the area in the short term. And Carney hopes to add sports betting if Massachusetts makes that legal. The State House of Representatives has approved sports betting, but hurdles remain. Approvals by the state Senate and Governor Charlie Baker. Demolition is expected to continue Wednesday. The work is leaving a tangle of steel, glass, and other materials that Carney compares to a spaghetti ball. Carney recalls that as a boy, he'd run up and down the back stairs of the grandstand up to the judge's room. As he was reminiscing, an excavator pulled the judge's booth down onto the growing debris pile. State economic growth slows to 2%. Analysts see slower spending ahead, citing the impact of COVID-19, by Colin Young from State House News Service. Growth in the Massachusetts economy slowed significantly during the third quarter, and economic analysts at Mass Benchmarks say the outlook for the next 6 months is less optimistic than it was previously, with the Delta variant persisting and consumer spending slowing. The state's real gross domestic product increased at a 2% annualized rate in the third quarter, matching the national growth rate for the same period, but stepping down from state growth rates of 6.1% in the first quarter and 8% in the second quarter, the publication from the University of Massachusetts Donahue Institute said. The slow drown in growth from the second quarter reflects the effects of the Delta variant of COVID-19, restraining the pace of reopening, continued supply chain disruptions and labor shortages, and less exuberant consumer spending on goods, especially durable goods, Alan Clayton Matthews, a Northeastern University professor emeritus and senior contributing editor of Mass Benchmarks, wrote. Much of the growth that did occur reflects increased consumer spending on services and job growth in the leisure and hospitality and other services sectors. Inflation means that consumer spending's effect on real output is diminished, and this also affects real GDP growth. Spending that is subject to the state's sales tax or motor vehicle sales tax declined at a 5.8% annual rate in the third quarter after having climbed by a 40.3% annual rate in the second quarter of the year. Clayton Matthews said the drop was fueled mostly by a shortage of motor vehicles that has contributed to a roughly 37% annual drop in their sales. Jobs in Massachusetts grew at a 6.9% annual rate in the third quarter as compared to a 4.3% annual rate in the second quarter. Employment has grown by 6.2% in Massachusetts versus 4.6% for the country over the last year, Mass Benchmark said. Though the state's unemployment rate climbed from 4.9% in June to 5.2% in September, Clayton Matthews said it could indicate more people returning to the workforce. One encouraging sign is that the number of persons who are working part-time but who want full-time work has returned to pre-pandemic levels. However, labor market conditions are still far from normal. In February 2020, the state's unemployment rate was 2.8%, or just over half of the September 2021 rate, he said. During the third quarter of 2021, which covers the same period of time as the first quarter of fiscal year 2022, the Massachusetts Department of Revenue collected $8.751 billion from residents and businesses, $1.501 billion, or 20% greater than actual collections during the same time period of fiscal 2021, and $525 million, or 6.4% above the administration's benchmark for the 3 months of July, August, and September. And state lawmakers are poised to pump another $3.65 billion into the economy as they debate legislation spending state surplus dollars and federal American Rescue Plan Act money into areas like housing, schools, and workforce development, while also stashing away another roughly $2.75 billion to be spent at a later date. For the fourth quarter of 2021 and first quarter of 2022, Mass Benchmark's analysts said it expects the Massachusetts economy to grow at a 4.5% annual rate, less optimistic than they were this summer, but consistent with continued gradual progress in getting back to normal, and assuming there is no seasonal COVID-19 surge as temperatures drop. Opinion. Parents say they want more choices in schools. We should listen. By Nina Reese. Schools are often regarded as the center of our society, and never has that been more true than now. Issues of health, safety, social justice, economics, and infrastructure intersect at the schoolhouse door. With so many different perspectives, who should we listen to? I say we should listen to parents. Parents living through the COVID-19 pandemic got an unexpected crash course in navigating the complex world of K-12 education, and they are quick learners. For many who saw their children wrestling with technology, disengaged or falling behind at home while their schools struggled to engage them in learning, there came an especially important lesson. There is another way. By the hundreds of thousands, families made the decision last year to enroll their children in charter schools, public schools that had the flexibility to adapt quickly during the crisis. Across the country, charter schools rapidly met children's and families' needs through remote learning, adapted curriculum, individual family outreach, even food and internet security. A report by the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools found charter school enrollment increased across the country as district public school enrollment decreased. Across 42 states, charter schools gained nearly 240,000 students, a 7% increase from the previous school year to 2020 to 21. Other public schools, including district-run schools, lost more than 1.4 million students, a 3.3% decrease from the previous school year. A pandemic anomaly, skeptics might say. Not so. Parents have been trying to tell us all along. Those who claim there's waning support for public charter schools are ignoring the data and shutting out the voices of parents who are voting with their feet and finding reassurance in places like Calhoun Falls Charter High School in Calhoun Falls, South Carolina, where they will meet Kalen Rogers. On any given day, you'll find Mr. Rogers, who is both an alumnus and the school principal, out on the field coaching the track team or behind the wheel of the school bus. He does anything it takes to support the students in grades 6 through 12 in his school. In the Cleveland area, another public charter, Randall Park High School, serves students in dropout recovery, providing not just classroom experience, but also hot meals and clothing. Students like those served by Randall Park High were particularly vulnerable during the pandemic, and it took extra effort to keep them on track. It's no wonder parents are demanding more schools like these. Across 45 states, territories, and Washington, D.C., more than 3.5 million children are enrolled in at least 7,500 public charter schools, and millions more are eager to enroll. Public charter schools are changing the American public education landscape for the better. Not convinced? A 2020 study from the Program on Education Policy and Governance at Harvard University found that students attending charter schools made greater academic gains from 2005 to 2017 than students in district-operated schools. The most significant gains came among Black students and those from low-income families. Perrone Family Makes Return to Burrillville's Conjuring House by Paul Edward Parker of the Providence Journal. Burrillville, Rhode Island. Andrea Perrone got the devastating news in a phone call when she was a 21-year-old senior at Chatham College in Pittsburgh. Her father, Roger Perrone, called, but he couldn't break it to her. Instead, he put Andrea's mother, Carolyn, on the phone. The house was sold. Andrea, now 63, related the distressing message. The farm was gone. This wasn't just any family home being sold while the kid is away at college. It is probably the most infamous house in Rhode Island, the inspiration for the movie The Conjuring. I thought I would be there my whole life, said Andrea, who was born in Central Falls and moved to the house on Round Top Road with her parents and four sisters when she was 12. This weekend was something of a homecoming as Andrea and her sister Nancy, 61, along with their father, 86, visited the house to take part in a live-streamed paranormal investigation there. The women's mother, Carolyn, 82, and two other sisters, Christine, 60, and Cindy, 58, stayed home in Georgia, joining the event virtually. The youngest Perrone sister, April, who was 5 when the family moved from Cumberland to the house in 1971, died in 2017 of an accidental overdose from a fentanyl patch prescribed in connection with a surgery. The phone call to Andrea in college was the result of Carolyn delivering her husband an ultimatum. My mother told my father she would not survive another winter in the house, Andrea said, before a luncheon for about 50 people at Wright's Farm Restaurant on Sunday. She had been under attack in that house for 10 years, Andrea said, of the malevolent spirits the family said had beset them. But that was only part of the reason, according to Andrea. The house is brutally cold in the winter. So the family moved to Georgia. She wanted to go home. Andrea, who now lives in Florida, said of her mother, and home for her was Georgia. All left the house except for Nancy, who persuaded the neighbors who bought the house to let her stay. A year later, Nancy moved to Chepachet. The Perrone family, Roman Catholics, had not been predisposed to believe in ghosts, Andrea said. The only time we heard that word was in church, the Holy Ghost. That changed almost as soon as they moved into the house on June 11, 1971. Things happened right away, said Andrea, who recounted seeing a full-bodied apparition that looked like flesh and blood to her. I said good morning to him. I always got along with the spirits right from the start, she said. I had moments of fear because I saw what was happening to my mom and to my family. She said different members of the family had different experiences living in the house, which is why only Nancy and her father joined her this weekend. We were the ones that never wanted to leave. So what happened this weekend? Andrea said they heard from a number of spirits through a spirit box, sort of a high-powered radio receiver that occasionally renders white noise static and intelligible words. Andrea said they made contact with April. She was right there, she said. Other spirits were saying her name. That was not the only message investigators received. The one thing that came through over and over last night was the word weep, said Andrea. Others interpreted that as the spirits trying to make Andrea cry, she said, but added, I don't think that they were. The family is mourning the death of Nancy's granddaughter, Lucy Connor, who was swept away during August floods in Waverly, Tennessee, and they're missing April. The spirits know how heartbroken we are, Andrea said. It's like they were acknowledging our loss. She said that after she dwelled among the dead for a decade, she has a different perspective on such losses. One thing that I do know, life goes on, she said. Death is not the end. It is the beginning of another journey. Even though the family left when Andrea was 21, she has always felt drawn to what she refers to as the farmhouse. Every now and then it just reaches out to me and says, come home. When The Conjuring premiered, Andrea saw Lorraine Warren, who with her husband Ed are the main characters of the movie and its two sequels. Now deceased, they were among the best-known paranormal investigators in the late 20th century. Ed, a self-described demonologist, and Lorraine, a clairvoyant and medium. Andrea told Lorraine Warren that she'd like to get the farmhouse back someday. Warren gave her an ominous warning. If you go back, you won't get out of it alive. The house has since been bought by Corey and Jennifer Heinzen, who rent it out overnight to people who style themselves as paranormal investigators. The Heinzens recently put the house on the market, but their asking price, $1.2 million, rules Andrea out. I'll let the universe decide whether this is our last visit to the farmhouse, she said. I don't need to own it. It owns me. Possible 16th century find in Burial Hill Dig by Rich Harbert. From Plymouth, the discovery of what may be a 16th century artifact on Burial Hill has researchers wondering if they've found the home of a pilgrim merchant. Archaeologists have been searching for evidence of the Pilgrims' first settlement for decades, but even 3 years ago, they still had not found where the Mayflower passengers built their first fort, let alone where they made their homes. But now, after excavations sandwiched around the pandemic, the discovery of coin weight, used to test the authenticity of money in the 1500s and 1600s, may help identify where a pilgrim tailor lived and worked. David Landon, Associate Director of the Fisk Center for Archaeological Research at UMass Boston, said more study is needed, but his team has likely unearthed evidence of a commercial enterprise, perhaps the home and attached shop of a merchant who lived just within the fort's northwest wall. Students under Landon's direction have been working in Plymouth for 5 weeks every summer since 2012. They discovered evidence of two buildings and part of the palisade wall while digging near the magnificent copper beech tree by the town square entrance to Burial Hill in 2019. The dig revealed evidence of post holes used for the palisade wall of the fort, as well as post holes used for the foundations of two adjoining buildings. The wooden posts rotted away over time, leaving darkened soil where they once stood. One of the buildings was built into the slope of the hill. It connected to the other structure with a cobbled passage or walkway. In 2019, the team also found a flat plate of wrought iron in the floor of the upper building and a bale seal in the passageway. The seal, in use from 1625 to 1649, would have served as a tax and inspection stamp on bales of cloth sent from England. The wrought iron could have been kept by a merchant for trade as raw material, Landon said. The archaeologists also found two English patent farthings, coins that were minted between 1614 and 1642. The researchers did not dig as planned in 2020 because of the global pandemic. But this year's team returned to the site and found a deeply buried building floor below where they had already been digging. The floor was under a layer of daub that they believed had been part of the building's original walls that collapsed and degraded over time. Beneath the daub, they found a coin weight that may have been produced in the late 1500s. Coin weights were used to ensure that different coins contained the proper amount of gold or silver. This weight that was found, about the size of a small, more modern postage stamp, was part of a set of weights manufactured by Hans Funk in Antwerp between 1577 and 1603. A stylized cross on the back of the weight suggests it was used to measure the legitimacy of a Spanish real coin. In addition, this year's team found bits of pipe, shot, an assortment of pottery, and everyday kitchenware fragments, as well as a fireplace with intact pieces of charcoal. The artifacts, along with the charcoal, are being analyzed at UMass Boston to see if they can shed more light on the settlement. Landon discussed details of this year's dig earlier this month during an online presentation of First Saturday History Tour, the monthly lecture series sponsored by the Plymouth Antiquarian Society and Pilgrim Hall Museum. Landon said the coin weight would have been part of a very specialized merchant's toolkit, and along with the bale seal, the farthings, the iron stock and the fireplace and pottery provides important clues to the settlement. It's pointing to this small but important cluster of artifacts that are giving us kind of a view of the commercial and mercantile aspects of the colony. So maybe this is pointing us to one of these buildings that had a dual function, Landon said. It had some company functions and was involved some with trade and commercial aspects of the colony, but also serving as someone's house on Burial Hill, with a fireplace and the pottery needed to prepare and eat their food. Could the two buildings once have belonged to Pilgrim Isaac Allerton, a tailor and merchant who would have had access to some of the artifacts found buried at the home site? Landon said it's hard to tell exactly whose house his team uncovered, but Allerton offers a tantalizing possibility. I do my archaeology with both my heart and my head, and with my heart I'll say Allerton, sure. Great connections there, the merchant connections and the cloth. With my head, I can't say whose house it is, Landon told history buffs during the October 2nd for Saturday lecture. We do try to puzzle this out. Do these artifacts give clues as to whose stuff we're looking at? I am not sure we've come to a good answer on that yet. Landon, who has spent nearly an entire year of his life supervising digs in Plymouth, said he's not sure yet if his team will be back in 2022. Landon said the past digs have unearthed so many soil samples and artifacts that his team could spend the coming year analyzing past finds in the laboratory. He said another separate school project could include checking all of the recent finds against discoveries made by other archaeologists in decades past. Landon challenges visitors to Burial Hill to find where his team had even been digging. His students receded after refilling the holes on Burial Hill, using a layer of permeable fabric to indicate where and how deep they had dug. We do it so we can dig it out for us and the future archaeologists, the people coming back for the 500th anniversary, Landon said. Maybe they won't need to dig at all. They'll have such great technology. In sports. Suddenly, the Pats Have Reason for Optimism by Mark Daniels of the Providence Journal. The Patriots looked buried not too long ago. They were a bad football team that played sloppy football. That's how it looked when they were 2-4. There was a four-game stretch when they went 1-3, the only win coming against a bad Houston Texans team. In one of the losses, the Cowboys' Dak Prescott set a record for the most passing yards thrown against a Bill Belichick Patriots defense. And then the Patriots blew out the New York Jets 54-13. The Jets with backup Mike White as quarterback for most of the game. Can you really trust a team whose only win came against the Jets and Texans? Can they actually beat a good football team? Well, on Halloween, the Patriots showed that they weren't dead. Neither are their 2021 playoff hopes following that 27-24 upset win on the road over the Los Angeles Chargers. We know we're a good team, said running back Damian Harris. We know we can play with anybody. We're capable of great things, added safety Adrian Phillips, but our main thing is we keep our heads down and keep working. There's no understating it. The Patriots' win on Sunday was huge. It showed the Patriots can beat a good opponent. The Chargers were 4-2 coming off a bye week. It showed the Patriots can win a close game. And more importantly, it showed the Patriots can support their rookie quarterback when things aren't going his way. Those things didn't happen in the first 7 weeks. The Patriots dug themselves in holes with turnovers, penalties, poor pass protection, and big chunk plays allowed on defense. They didn't seem like the kind of team that could overcome mental mistakes. On Sunday, the Patriots turned the ball over in field goal range when Kendrick Bourne fumbled in the third quarter. The offense even made it to the one-yard line and turned the ball over on downs. There were wasted opportunities. This could have been the recipe for another tough loss where you'd scream, well, if this didn't do this or if he didn't do that, we would have won. Except this time the opposite happened. The Patriots' defense stepped up with a valiant effort against a very good quarterback in Justin Herbert and forced two interceptions. The pass rush, which we talked about all summer, made life difficult for Herbert. Sure, there were breakdowns, a 75-yard run by Josh Jackson, a 41-yard reception by Keenan Allen, and a 24-yard touchdown pass at the end by Josh Palmer. But the Patriots stayed in the game due to their defense and special teams. We're starting to turn that page and believing in ourselves and believing how to win football games, said center David Andrews. That's a big thing. I'm proud of the team. I keep telling you all, we know what kind of team we have, said Matthew Judon. We just have to go out and prove it.